Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today, Julia Samwell is talking about The Last Taboo.
Hello everybody. Julia is, it's a fantastic book, a fantastic scholarship, so you might be wondering what on earth I'm doing here, so I'll quickly explain. I know Julia a bit personally, but then went to her professionally when my wife and I lost a child very late on in pregnancy, and it was an extraordinary moment in our lives that defined much of what has followed. And since then, Julia and I have been in a dialogue, and she was writing about grief, and every time I've talked to her, I've always felt very strongly that actually what she was writing was a history book. And she's occasionally a little bit reluctant to accept that, because I think you're very modest, and you don't want to claim that you're a historian, but in fact you are a historian, and this book demonstrates that, and I think this talk will demonstrate that today. And it's two things I love, two of the reasons I really want to be up on stage here today. One is because it's a comparative history, I'm a generalist, I'm not a period specialist. This is a history of our relationship with death and bereavement from the Stone Age to the present day. And two is it's an area in which I think history can have a really positive impact on our lives. So you're not just studying history because you're fascinated by the heavy cavalry at Agincourt and because it's a kind of amusing intellectual pastime. You're interested in history because you're interested in lessons and you're interested in things that can really improve your life and shape a future that you want. So that's why I'm doing it, just before anyone asks. Julia, we got lots of slides that you're going to show us, but I guess my first question is, what is it? How did you choose death?
Or did it choose me?
Did it choose you?
I think like with most people, I came to it from personal experience, in that I was brought up by two parents, a generation who had enormous amount of loss before they were 25, and never talked about their loss or their grief. We had many black and white photographs around the house of my grandfather, my grandmother, my uncles and my aunts, and I never knew anything about them. And so it was very unvoiced.
And sorry, why did they? Was it a wartime thing? Why were they?
My uncle was killed in the war, and the others had died early and unexpectedly, and it triggered an interest in what people don't say, what isn't talked about. Because I kept on seeing these photographs and I never knew the stories behind them. And then I was told many years later, my mother told me like 25 years later, the time that she was told her uncle Tony, her brother, my uncle Tony, died. She was at Edinburgh Cookery School and she was 17 and she was called out of the class. And she was told that he was killed in Arnhem. She didn't say anything, she didn't cry. She walked back into the class, she finished her lesson, she didn't tell anybody, and she went to a Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers film in the evening. And she never really spoke about it again. But when she spoke about it 25 years later, it was like a live video inside her. And how that links to the talk today is that, you know, grief is invisible. And death is still very much taboo, and yet we all know that we're going to die. We all know that those around us are going to die. And there's a kind of, I think, magical thinking that if I don't think about it and if I don't talk about it, it isn't going to happen. And the culture that surrounds us, that impacts us, that I then see the impact of that with the people who sit in front of me who have partners or parents or children that die, because there's this feeling that they should be doing better or feeling better than they do. So for this talk, for my book, I look back and then look more. And, you know, our grief, our history is for our character as a nation is formed by our history, and our experience is informed by our individual family culture, but also our broader culture. And
So speaking of culture, how have you studied? You've studied the way that all of these different cultures throughout history have dealt with something that they all have in common, and the differences presumably are vast, are they? Or is there anything that's the same?
What's universal, going back to the sort of beginning of time that we know, is that all societies have come up with solutions and beliefs and rituals around the fact of death, the relationship to the person that's died, the dead person, and their own mortality. And it's those three that form the kind of structure of our belief system and how we respond when someone has died. And that has been true as long as we know. And I think why we have rituals is that because grief is invisible and death is so frightening, we like structure. We like a ritual because we then know how to behave. It's familiar. Like, you know what to do if there's a funeral. There's kind of steps that you have to take. But also, if you have faith or you have a kind of belief system, it gives you meaning over something that is incredibly painful. Because the two most intense feelings around grief are fear and pain. Pain is the agent of change. Pain is the thing that forces you to adjust to the reality that this person that you love has died. And people do everything they can to block the pain or avoid the pain. And I think funerals and rituals give you a structure to manage that uncertainty, that chaos.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit in about how we've sort of junked all of our rituals. And actually, I think that's particularly fascinating. But let's look at some of the slides. So what is this?
So this is Lan Yen Quote. I don't quite know how to say that, Quoit. And it's one of our oldest monuments. It's in Cornwall, and it's 4000 BC. And it's a dolmen. So it was a burial site where burial sites were always on the top of a hill. And it's thought that there was a sort of sacred link between the burial site and people working below. And the thing I sort of wondered about with this was that both if you look up to the stone, you then look sort of up to heaven. And so you keep in relationship with the person that's died, with the burial site. But also through time, we've used stone, you know, very big stones, as in this case, or tombstones. And stones are one of the few things that are permanent. I mean, they don't...
They're the opposite of this stuff.
They're the opposite of our mortality. And so when I work with people, often I suggest that they may have a stone, a sort of touchstone that they keep in their pocket that connects them to the person that died, and it gives them a kind of connection to them. And these big stones or smaller stones, I think, are our kind of striving to have something that's concrete, that's stone, that's solid.
I mean, that is a remarkable bit of continuity. We still have gravestones today, 6,000 years later. Amazing.
So this is a Roman coffin. This was found in Newcastle, and it's 350 AD. And it was found with a pottery beaker in it. And the Romans, I think, actually are the sort of antecedents of our attitudes to death in many ways, because they often cremated and they occasionally buried. And the pottery beaker, I mean, even now, you know, my mum died this year and I put letters in and things into her coffin that sort of somehow, you know, I don't really believe in anything, but you want to connect, you want to put something in for them to take some of you with them in some way. And this pottery beaker was in the coffin, in this stone coffin. But also the dual attitudes that we have to death are apparent. So there's a quote from Catullus, who marched miles in misery to seek his brother who'd been killed. And the quote from him when he found him was that all there was molten ashes. That was all that there was left. So that kind of really kind of deep pain of his loss. But also, of course, there are the Stoics, who have a very recognizable attitude, which is, this is Seneca, which he said, "Nothing becomes so offensive so quickly as grief, when fresh it finds someone to console it. But when it becomes chronic, it's ridiculed, and rightly." And that certainly matches our attitude today, that you're kind of given a certain amount of time to grieve, aren't you? You're allowed kind of 3 months or even a number of weeks, and then you're meant to get on with it. And the thing I've learned is that we need both. You know, at the moment of the death, we have two, as human beings, we have two instinctive responses that we We want to feel our pain and find an expression for our grief, to be loss-oriented. But also we're scared of it. We want to restore, we want to be okay, we want to move forward. And actually, if you allow yourself to move between the two, to do both, you then adjust and live again and find a way of loving again, given that the person has died. But if you block the loss orientation, or you only do the restoration, then you don't adjust, and that's when you can sort of get into psychological difficulty.
Very nice. What have you got next?
So this is incredibly beautiful. I don't know if any of you have seen it. This is the burial, the ship burial of Raedwald, king of East Anglia. This is 600 AD. It was found in Woodbridge in Suffolk. And it's a ship burial. And it was full of these, of this incredible helmet of his, as well as many other kind of artifacts and treasures. And again, it's a sort of echo of the Roman one of, you know, if you were very poor, there's no remains. You know, you were buried probably with a cloth around you in unconsecrated ground. So only at this time, the very kind of great and the very rich, is there anything to be found. The thing that I thought was sort of interesting about him was this sort of continuing relationship that you know, when I work with people, when the person has died, they feel very connected to the body of the person. You know, the people, the pathologists, the mistake they've made when they've done sort of errors and examined bodies without parents' permission or without people's permission, is they think of it as an object. Whereas a dead body to the person who's related to them feels almost more alive, dead than alive. They feel very protective of them. You know, I often hear people talking about, I was worried they were cold, I was worried they were frightened, I didn't want to leave them in the mortuary. And so it feels like with this was a kind of someone who could afford it, who was really taken care of for his future and thought about and sort of remembered after his death.
When you wrote this book, did you keep, were you astonished at the variation of people's responses to death, or was it the universal things that really struck you? Did you feel a link and a kinship with people in the past, or do you think, wow, it's past different country?
It feels that there's an absolute direct link of us finding a way of battling with something we don't have control of. And as human beings, wanting to have hope, wanting to believe, and wanting to find some way of organizing over something that is so unknowable. And even, you know, when we all come to it, when we come to the 21st century, but it feels like it's been a historic battle that there isn't a resolution to. But as human beings, we always want to have control, and we would like to, you know, make sure everything's okay. You know, we want to survive in some way. That's such a primary instinct.
And ship burials are an amazing example of humans trying to recreate life in the afterlife.
I mean, I don't know, do you think he thought, you know, that they're going to kind of go into the water as they travel, you know, like, because of course the Romans, they crossed the river, didn't they, with a coin. So I don't know whether there was still, it was on the Christian pagan continuum, so I don't know whether they felt that, they imagined it was a river they crossed or sea or... It's very tangible though.
That's how I want to go.
Yeah.
My wife needs to start building that ship in the garden. Yeah.
So this is very touching. This is Richard Fitzalan of Arundel and his second wife, Eleanor. And it's in the Middle Ages, at the time where they were building, you know, churches to the glory of God. And when you were alive in that time, you had a very personal, all-seeing God. I mean, she was very... That your life was organized like to be good in your life so that you could go to heaven. Days were organized by saints' days, and death was an ever-present presence. You know, you were never more likely to die as a woman than when you gave birth. I mean, she was his second wife, probably because the first wife had died in childbirth. 4 out of 5 children died under 5. Your life expectation was 35 years. You got married at 12. And you died if anything went wrong. You know, there was famines, there was war, and there was hunger. And the minute you were ill, you were dead. So the whole relationship was dead. That death was, it was a very present, personal God that was watching you. And the belief was that the more people that witnessed your dying, the better your passage to heaven was. So that when you were dying, your room became a public place. And if someone saw a priest carrying a viaticum, which is the kind of blessing ointment when you died, they would follow the priest and come in to your room where the shutters were closed, candles were lit, incense was burned. And then it was a public place. Total strangers would be there witnessing and praying for your death, praying for you to go to heaven, which is, I mean, we really couldn't be more reversed now, where a lot of people die alone and die in a hospital with nobody present at all.
Why do you think it... I really struggle to understand that bit. Why do you think the families, or why do you think that culture wanted death to be so public?
I don't really... I mean, I think it was this absolute faith in God. I mean, it was blasphemous to pray against death. You had to accept death. It was sort of intimidating time, in a sense, that it was everything about what was going to happen to you in the afterlife, because death was so bloody short. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you died that young, the afterlife was the time that really mattered.
Yeah. You mentioned, I don't want to hold up on this because a lot of slides look at it, but you mentioned that child mortality thing that I can never get over that when you're studying history. And the hard thing for me to understand, and I've read quite a bit and I still know near understanding, is did people just live with crushing grief all the time? Were they better at getting over it, or did they just love their kids less? Because you have a kid, be like, well, I'm not out of the woods yet. Let's wait till it's five before I really bond with this child. Like, how did that work?
I mean, I don't know, but when I've seen quotes from, say, the Victorians or the 18th century, the loss of the child is devastating. Mm. It's still devastating. And then, you know, child mortality, at the end of the Victorian times, 500,000 children died. 2001, 5,000 children died. So, I mean, I think a death of a child is always devastating, but I think also in sort of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, your instinct is you have to survive. So your first drive is to survive. So if if you're a hunter-gatherer or you're plowing the field and you're working and you have to get food and roof over your head, you work even though your heart is kind of breaking. Mm. We have much more of a sort of luxury and opportunity to grieve now in a way that I think people then never did.
So does grief expand to fill the space available?
That's a bloody hard question.
Well, you know, the audience are very demanding.
I think that's true to some extent. I think, I don't know if it fills space. I think, when we are in an environment where grief is facilitated and we can find a way of expressing it, it in some ways actually processes it faster. Mm. I think if you block it and shut down your pain, it stays sort of blocked in you and you kind of function fine, but your capacity to feel is foreshortened. Because if you cut off joy, you cut off your capacity to feel. If you cut off pain, you cut off your capacity to feel joy. So you function fine, but your engagement in life is diminished. That's my answer.
That's a good answer. I'll take that.
The only other thing I wanted to add that is in my notes is that, of course, then when they were praying, and you could pay people to pray for you. So if you were rich, he would very much have paid people to pray for his soul. You prayed for your soul to go to heaven and not to go to purgatory, the kind of halfway place or hell, and that was that your biggest aim was that you'd be prayed for to go to heaven.
Let's not forget, people, 14th century, world's worst time to be alive. Between a third and a half of the British population died in the space of 18 months in the middle of the 14th century from the Black Death. Crazy.
Yes, because I'm talking about the Black Death in this slide.
Oh, that was good. Brilliant.
So this is called the Ars Moriendi. It's the first ever text on the art of dying, on the protocols of dying. And it was incredibly popular. It was translated, probably not as in many languages as my book.
All right. Stop showing off. Goodness me.
And again, it was saying the same thing, that you had to live a kind of blessed, good life in the steps of Jesus in order not to go to purgatory or hell, to go to heaven. But also the thing it was really saying is that you had to be present for your own death. Again, the opposite of now. So that if you were present with death in your own death, you could commune with God and you were more likely to go to heaven. And it was blasphemous. It, you know, a sudden death was the worst thing that could happen to you. But there was still a lot of pain. So this is a 15th century poet called March who was lamenting the death of his wife. And he says, "Why does an event so common as death seem so severe to whomever it wounds? Why at times does man's reason retreat and the passions muster all their power? God, compassionate, just, seems cruel to us." So, I mean, that is no different from someone talking now, is
totally,
it?
Totally.
Although death was an everyday occurrence for everybody.
In fact, it must have seemed even more, because it must have been even more, at least now if you lose a child, you think, well, no one else I know has lost a child, so I'm justifiably fairly broken by this. But in those days they felt, I'm dying here, and yet everyone else has been through this. It must have been very difficult.
I mean, I can see that the compensations of heaven were just about the only thing you could hope for, weren't they? So, I mean, I think you can talk much more about this than me, but this is the 16th century, which is after 150 years of the Reformation. Are you good on this?
Yeah. Bit nervous about what you're going to say next. Yeah.
So we're a Protestant country now.
Yes.
So all the things I've been talking about purgatory, are now gone. You no longer prayed for the soul. Mourning and sort of incense and candles were gone. And it was sort of womanly and not moral to grieve openly. Mm. You needed to be more stoic. It absolutely broke the bonds with the Catholic Church, and it became much more utilitarian.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is true, but it seems to me more about man than God at this point.
Okay, that's interesting. That would make sense, I guess, because that's what happened with the Reformation. It stripped the colour and the life out of popular religiosity, so that makes a lot of sense.
There was no more purgatory. Purgatory was gone. So still, I think Catholics believe in purgatory, don't they?
Yeah.
But here we don't.
Huh. And are you in a
I think it's an improvement. I mean, I don't know. You get to the top floor or the bottom floor. So is it worse? I don't know.
I should probably ask you this at the end, but I just want to ask it now. So we see this big shift in British life. Have you, in all the people you've met, all the research you've done, all the thinking you've done about this subject, have you decided that there is, like, actually lots of pomp and ceremony and incense and families and public is better, or is a private, intense, small death and grieving process better?
I mean, I think two things. I think one, it has to be, although the feelings are often very universal, how you want to express them and the support that you need is very, very individual. So for some people, a big, kind of noisy, lots of people funeral would be absolutely impossible for them to manage. But the single biggest predictor of a good outcome for someone who's bereaved is connection to others, is the love of others. When love dies, it's the love of others that helps us heal. And so funerals, where people gather together, they come together and they support you. I even imagine being in the room with you when you're dying would be supportive, you know, because isolation, being alone, is the thing that most people tell me is so difficult about grieving.
Okay.
The other thing was that it was no longer blasphemous to want to live, to kind of not want to die. It was accepted that it was all right to die. I don't know why how the Protestants brought that in, but.
Neither do I.
I hoped you might know. And of course, I don't know if this is useful, but that Shakespeare is alive at this time. And, you know, he again talks in the same way as all of us talk now, in language that, I mean, these are very well known. This is from Henry VI, part three. To weep is to make less the depth of grief. I mean, that's basically what I say in my book, you know, that you need to express it. And then give sorrow words. That's probably the most kind of well-known expression about loss. And that's from Shakespeare then.
So you've plagiarised, you like everybody else, just plagiarising Shakespeare.
Yeah, I never said I was new. So this is, I think what I'm thinking, I'm really not a historian, is that we're moving away from churches that are ornate and away from God being ever-present and God being the one that has a kind of personal power over you and you relate to God. And now, and you know, the person that's dead prays for you and you pray for the dead person, this kind of interweaving, it's much more delineated and it's much more boundaried. And this is a monument to the second Marquess of Rockingham. So it feels like it's much more a celebration of man, you know, this huge monument to one man. And at this time, grieving, it was much more about mourning the dead. So it was the first time women wore black. This is the first time it came in as a way of expressing your grief, was to show that you're wearing black. And women, even then, were still not allowed to go to funerals, but they were very involved in preparing the person that had died for the viewing of the body. So it would be the women in the family, the sisters, the children, or the servants, or the wife, that prepared the body. But they never went to the funeral. But it's the beginning of what is, again, familiar about wearing black and sort of grieving at the funeral, but in a more contained, kind of stoic way.
Women doing all the work, men taking credit. Sounds strangely familiar to...
We don't... I mean, religiously, you know, Jews, Muslims do prepare a body, but I don't know if it's true of other people here, but certainly CV, the funeral director, does it. So we have no contact with the person when they've died. So that's one of the things that's really gone. And often if they die in hospital on a ward, they're taken to the mortuary and lots of people don't see the body.
So it's almost like every other aspect of our lives, what used to be a family responsibility has been sent to the state, to the institutions, to private sector.
To tidy it up.
Yeah. Because we think somehow it's less. Is that because, you know, it's less mess? I don't know. It's less personal. It's less. Get someone else to handle it.
I think it's about. There's this thing: if I don't touch it or look at it or think about it or see it, it's going to hurt less. Mm. And actually, in my experience, the opposite is true. That if you don't have a memory of it, you don't have an experience of it, you don't have a focus for your grief. So it's much more kind of crazy making, because you know that you feel unsettled, you know that you feel sad, but you don't have an image that makes sense of that for you, that fits. Does that make sense?
It does. I'm just thinking about my own experience.
This also, at this time, was the beginning of medical treatment. So before, obviously, there were potions and things, but this is the first kind of doctors were beginning to train. But most of the medical treatments then just made everybody worse, or certainly didn't make them better. But I guess the sort of second phase where we're fighting against death, we're not accepting death, it's man having power over death. Mm. And my husband found some research about cemeteries, which they became overpopulated. And sometimes you would bury people in stacks. Sometimes the burial grounds were 20 feet high above the ground level. And sometimes the bodies were only in the grave for a couple of hours, and then they'd be chucked in a common grave, and another person would be buried in the same spot.
Amazing.
quite brutal.
A historian I was reading the other day talking about post-Enlightenment or scientific revolution, so this kind of period to now, the great unspoken aim of science has been to overcome death. And
is it unspoken?
I think maybe it isn't unspoken. Still not that many doctors and scientists who go, what we really want to do is nail this death thing by the end of my life. but that's sort of... But it's becoming more articulated, certainly recently, isn't it?
Certainly. I mean, we're going to look at that.
OK, good. Right. Let's keep going.
So now we've got Queen Victoria, who... She was really the poster woman for death. She... You could talk about death in the Victorian times. You couldn't talk about sex in the way that we can now. And now we don't talk about death and we can talk about sex. Not very accurately, in my opinion, but we can't talk about death. And she never got out of her widow's weeds. She went to both her daughters' weddings wearing black. She wore these caps with weepers, which represented tears. She had handkerchiefs that embroidered in black and white tears in her handkerchiefs. And being, the empress, she made it fashionable to mourn. So both the upper classes, the middle classes, and the working classes copied her. So if you couldn't afford to buy these black bombazine dresses, you could rent them from, and there were funeral societies and burial societies. And there were, in Regent Street alone, there were three warehouses where you could get funeral gear. I mean, it became, incredibly fashionable and popular. And the memorials became very fashionable and popular. And it became much, the whole thing became much more extravagant. The thing I kind of wonder about is if she'd been a man, would she have been allowed to grieve in that way? Because it was accepted, because she was a woman, I think. Or maybe, I don't know. I mean, would a man, if she died and Albert had lived, I mean, he wouldn't have been king, but...
Yeah, that's a funny way of looking at it. I was going to say, was the other way around, which is because she was a woman, was she expected to just live in grief in perpetuity?
I mean, if you look at the research, men and women do grieve very differently. So women do tend to be preoccupied with the grief, to be very kind of absorbed by it. And men tend to want to go on. They want to fix things. So when partners die, the kind of expression is women mourn and men replace. And I mean, the research backs it up. 70% of men, if they're young enough, are married within the year of their wife's death.
Oh.
And women often don't marry again. But the men that don't marry again fare very badly because they're not good at looking after themselves and they're not connected to others. but also this is not really to do with Queen Victoria, but there's very good research that shows that physiologically your heart actually hurts, that there's an infarction, is that the word, medical word? That your heart, if you're grieving someone you really love, I was sent a man sent me an email this week who was really annoyed that I didn't write about long marriages in my book. He'd been married for 55 years and his wife had died. And he sent me a link from the BMJ that showed that your heart actually does suffer a kind of illness, an attack. And you are actually, within the first 6 weeks of someone you love dying, you're more likely to die.
You are heartbroken.
You are actually heartbroken. That was the term I was looking for. How are we doing?
Good. We're going to save some time for some questions. Okay, so let's just
I might whiz past Albert.
Poor old
but
Albert.
But he's basically saying... this is like Rockingham, but with knobs on. This is really a massive memorial to a man. This is much more about man than God. But also things were changing. There was drainage.
Sewers.
That's the word.
I see what you mean, yeah.
There was sewers. Life expectancy had increased now to 55. The population doubled by the end of the 19th century, and there was the Origin of Species Darwin. So this was another kind of step away from God and towards man. And medicine, the first vaccine was developed at this time. So that was our first real medicine that actually did
work,
begin to save lives. Yeah. And then we have the First World War, which you really know much more about than I do. Do you want to say?
Well, lots of people, so the First World War obviously we had to confront death on an industrial scale, and this idea of repatriation of the bodies, and it was felt, well, I think there's loads of things to say about the First World War. First of all, the scale of loss was so epic, but also for the first time we felt that these individuals that were lost were worthy of memory and memorialization, because previously Private Jones has been piled into an unmarked grave on a distant battlefield, and some officers might be brought back or some of that. And now, because of the changes, the democratization of our society, that if you, no matter who you were, it was felt you ought to have a gravestone, your family, you were somebody. You had died so that the country could go on, and that sacrifice was worthy of memorial. And so the bodies were left. Lest they be forgotten. And also there was a fundamental problem that you couldn't bring the bodies back because there were too many of them.
700,000.
Yeah. And so they were buried. And so these graveyards, I'm sure many of us have been to these cemeteries in the Western Front, they do several jobs, don't they? Because they, on the one hand, they commemorate the scale of the dead, and they try, I think, and do a job at reminding us who are left of the folly of war. But they are also imperial places, I think, and they're places where, you know, the French and the British cemeteries are places where there is it's dignified, but there is also something about the majesty of the empires for which they died. So there's lots of jobs being done, but I don't know how, and I wonder how the families, I think, and then families were determined to go out and visit these graves. I mean, it became a huge thing in the 1920s. France was flooded with families going out to see where where their loved ones had died. And now, interesting, there's a vast industry in finding new soldiers, identifying them, having buried the proper ceremony, added to walls. There's a real sense in which having no known grave is still a terrible stain on the family in terms of its ability to recover and commemorate.
And if you go back to the Lanyon quote, that at that time, if your body wasn't buried and kind of blessed, it was felt that the soul didn't go to the afterlife.
Yeah.
And so there's still that feeling and this relationship with the body, you know, 2,000, whatever it is, 4,000 years later.
Yeah, it's funny. Also, when you hear about, when I was listening to the Hillsborough stuff the other day, they didn't feel they could rest until someone had been blamed. And I think maybe it's the same. Until you have found the body, until there's a ritual, whether it's blaming someone for their loss or memorialising it, there's a closure that people obviously need to feel before they, what's that about? Or are they just lying to themselves?
I don't think it's blame. The thing that drives people mad is having unanswered questions.
Yeah, okay.
The piece of the jigsaw that's missing, the piece of information that they don't know, that hasn't been written down by the ambulance driver or the doctor or in Hillsborough, becomes the focus for all of the sort of loss. And it torments and leaves the person kind of, in a way, in purgatory, in limbo.
Yeah.
And I don't really believe in closure, but you can't begin to come to terms with the fact of someone's death, particularly a sudden, and in that case, kind of very violent, unexpected death, until you have a narrative, until you have a real story of understanding of what happened, why it happened, and how it happened. And once you can have that, you can begin to find a way of living with the reality of it. But when there's unanswered questions, they haunt you. And they drive you mad.
Yeah.
And those Hillsborough families were never given proper psychological support. I mean, their lives stopped on that day, and they never really lived again. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible sort of story of misunderstanding of the consequences of an event like that.
Well, and the First World War was that times, well, literally 700,000, wasn't it? Because, I mean, I've seen letters where an unopened letter to a brother at the front was just returned, killed in action, unopened to the family, and that was how they found out. And that was all the psychological state, the support the British state was able to provide.
Because the other part of that is the task of mourning is to find a way of living with the reality of the death. If you never see the body, how do you know in your head as well as your heart that the person has died? Mm. And what you imagine is kind of limitless. And so those families and the families from the Second World War, when they never saw the body, the widows and the children often thought when the door opened, it wasn't true, that their husband, their father would come back. There's this kind of ghostliness that, you know, maybe they were one of the lucky ones, because of course there were stories of people coming back. So you actually, you need the experience, you need the factual knowing in your head as well as your heart.
And that was why in the 1920s there was an absolute explosion of seances and all that kind of insane stuff. And you'd fill the Albert Hall and people would ask for their loved ones to come back and talk to them and ask what had actually
happened. It was unfinished. It was so unfinished. There was and so much that was unknown. We're going to skip fast.
Right, let's skip some because we want to have some questions.
So the 20th century, as we've seen from the First World War, it was a biological imperative to survive. And so my parents' generation, who were brought up by the survivors of the First World War, death, although in some families it may be spoken about, it was very much keep calm and carry on, stiff upper lip, because they had to build up life again. And then they fought in another war. And medicine became successful. Medicine actually saved lives. So death, really through the 20th century, became almost entirely hidden. It was done by funeral directors. People died in hospitals. Cremations from doing kind of 5 or 10% at the beginning of the century. Now 75 to 80% of funerals are cremations. So it became much more mechanized and much more distance from anyone that was involved with the death. And in my book, not my actual book, in my kind of thinking, that gave a whole generation an inability to connect with how they feel and find a way of expressing themselves. Then we've got some quite funny... It's brilliant. That isn't here. So that one, which is my favourite, it's in America. But I thought we had to have it because it's so good. But I mean, can you imagine the 13th century Rodwald laughing and told you I was sick? So, you know, we're laughing much more. This is Patrick Caulfield, and that says dead. And then there's Jim Stanford Horde, who loved books. So our attitude to death is much less one of fear, but it's wanting control. It's medicine succeeds. So now, in this century, you know, a child born today, they're likely to live until they're 115. I don't know what all the other stats are. Very few people wear black. So now you have QRs for gravestones, so that you can
watch a short film.
Watch a short film. And you can have digital gravestones, so that which can be uploaded all the time. People have destination funerals. You can have a funeral in a football stadium. You can have a funeral in a gallery. You can have a funeral wherever you like. Lots of coffins now are no longer black or woven. They're painted in someone's football strip or their favourite. I saw a picture of their favourite thing was a chalk ice. So they had the coffin as a chalk ice.
There's a clue there.
Lots of people...
Fewer chalk ices, more life.
Don't wear black, they wear colour. The majority in this country, I mean, I don't know because of the difference of changing, but don't have a religion, so there are humanistic funerals. And what it feels like is the 20th century felt like it was a kind of a survival century which had to deny death in order to survive. And now at the beginning of the 21st century, I think we have a kind of arrogance that we are bloody well not going to die. We're going to make it. You can imagine someone like Elon Musk coming up with some kind of program that is going to ensure that he is going to live until he's 145.
They are all the big, those guys are working on those things as we speak, yeah.
Absolutely. So that's my, that's the end.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.